Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jim Ruddy, your host, and we're back from our break, and we're talking to Eric Zarin. He is the chairman of the Andrew Carnegie Hero Fund Commission, and that's a lot to get on your T-shirt. But he is a former 25 years as a Secret Service agent, and now has been working with the Hero Fund for a number of years and joins us every week to talk about the heroes. What heroes do you have for us today, Eric?
Well, Jim, we got a couple of good ones for you here. This first one is from file number 71224, and it's the case of Holly L. Garlitz. Holly rescued Nicholas K. Mensa from assault in State College, PA on September 17, 1996. A woman who was armed with a rifle and a hunting knife concealed herself in a planting of trees and bushes in a corner of a large open lawn on the university's campus. Firing several times, she killed one student, sadly, grazed the backpacks of two others, and seriously wounded Mensa, who was 22 at the time, and who was walking on a path several hundred feet away. Mensa fell to the ground. Walking on the same path, Garlitz, who was 22, a college student, took cover behind a tree after seeing Mensa fall. But concluding that Mensa remained vulnerable in his exposed position, Ms. Garlitz left her cover, hurried to him, and grabbed him by an arm, dragged him to the tree for cover. The sniper was disarmed by another student. Mensa was hospitalized for treatment of his gunshot wound, which required surgery. That's the case of Holly Garlitz. You may remember that's a few years ago, but that was at Penn State's campus in State College, Pennsylvania.
Wow, and you never think of anything happening in State College like that. That's a college town and just a pretty little town in the middle of Pennsylvania. And did they ever determine what caused the shooter to do that?
I'm not sure that they did, Jim. And if they did, I don't have that part of the story in front of me. But as you know, it's just a story that plays out more routinely, and I think more often now than it did back then. And so we're trending in the wrong direction. But what we see in all of these incidents is, you know, that in most cases, in mass shooting incident or an active shooter situation, heroism is so often exhibited by people who were either in a place of safety or could have escaped to safety, which is, I think, was the case here. But they're also difficult cases for the commission to consider. And we always dig in, and we always try to do our best and see if there's an awardable situation. But, you know, it's difficult because investigations follow, criminal charges follow in many cases, and a lot of the records that we build our case on aren't available immediately, and sometimes it takes months, if not years. And then the other challenge to it is we're always conscious of widespread heroism, or if we recognize an individual, were there others that we couldn't possibly recognize that may have also acted heroically? So we work through those situations, but those situations often, you know, cause some challenges, but we're happy to work through them because so often, you know, there is heroism exhibited that could qualify for the Carnegie Medal, and it's not to be ignored, and it's extraordinary.
Every time I hear these stories, I think about the shooting in Uvalde, Texas. And the fact that if we'd had some of the Carnegie heroes there that day, it might have been a different outcome.
I agree. I've seen it over and over, Jim. We as an organization have seen it. And, you know, you can never tell a book by its cover, both ways. I mean, we have many heroes that we talk to that tell us, you know, they are the last people that they ever would have expected to act in a certain situation. And they kind of surprise themselves. But then often, you know, people who you would expect, especially if they're equipped and trained to deal with the situation and they fail to do so.
Yes.
Of course, we expect better. But you never know until you're in that situation. These folks, these Carnegie heroes through the years, they have been put to the ultimate test. It's the only test that matters. They respond in the appropriate way and risk their lives in the process. So as did our next case, we'll get to the case of Joseph Sienko. And Joseph Sienko, at the age of 43, was a heat treating helper who saved Dominic J. LaScola, a heat treating helper, from drowning in Pittsburgh April 30th, 1956. So while working near a large quenching tank in a heat treating plant, LaScola fell into the open tank, the top of which was level with the floor, and was submerged in water about 12 feet deep. The temperature of the water from which steel forgings were heated, to 1,600 degrees, had been taken 20 minutes earlier and was approximately 180 degrees.
Wow.
So Sienko, who was working nearby, saw the accident, immediately jumped into the tank. And as Sienko groped for him 4 feet beneath the surface, LaScola, who could not swim on top of it, suddenly grasped Sienko's shoulders. And although his arms had been weakened by the heat of the water, Sienko tried to push LaScola toward the surface. Lascola then put one knee on Cienka's shoulder, forcing him downward. So again, we have a situation where a victim is causing significant peril to someone who's trying to rescue them. Now, as Lascola rose to the surface 3 feet from the edge of the tank, his foot kicked Cienka's face. Cienko, by then greatly weakened, struggled to the surface beside Lascola, and both men were assisted from the tank by another workman. Lascola suffered burns over most of his body, but recovered in 10 weeks. Cienko also sustained extensive burns, but he too recovered in about 4 weeks' time.
Wow. Can you imagine being in 180-degree water and not having in a tank? It didn't have steps. It didn't have a handrail or anything.
Exactly.
That's really got to be frightening.
Hot water, difficult egress, and a panicked victim who could not swim.
Wow.
Yeah, add it all up, but it really creates a significant peril. And Sienk would have known well the dangers involved, again, because his familiarity, the dangers of that work environment, and did not hesitate, sustained significant burns in the rescue, but, you know, jumped right in when acting impulsively, as we see over and over, as the case with all of these heroes. No obligation to act, but there's an impulse that strikes them that they cannot resist and just causes almost immediate action, almost in all cases.
Well, it also reminds us that workplaces can be dangerous. And I remember my friend, the late Paul O'Neill, who was Secretary of the Treasury and headed up Alcoa, and his goal was to make Alcoa worldwide the safest company in the world. And he accomplished that. And his ethic for safety was just unbelievable. And he did a wonderful job. It's too bad that not every company president feels that way. They, you know, they leave the safety to someone else. But you see these stories over and over and over again in the workplace.
I had the honor of serving on Secretary O'Neill's protective detail for a short period of time. Years ago, and he certainly was an honorable man and a great representative of Western Pennsylvania himself.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, for those that you don't know, Eric Zarin, our representative of the Kearney Hero Fund, was a Secret Service agent for 25 years and could probably tell us a lot of stories about that.
Well, Jim, I like to say I've had a kind of a front row 360-degree seat, and I've worked with and observed many heroes in my life, both from my past work experiences, and certainly in the last 6 or so years that I've had the privilege and the honor to work with the Hero Fund Commission.
Well, tell us what brought you to Pittsburgh. Is it you felt like you wanted to come back after being all over the world as a Secret Service agent?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, Jim. My wife and I always, my wife is also from here, she's from Bloomfield in the city of Pittsburgh, and we always wanted to get back. And we came back in 2009, somewhat bittersweet circumstances. My brother-in-law, was Officer Paul Schillo with the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police, who was killed in an ambush in 2009, along with two other officers. So that's ultimately what got us back home to Pittsburgh, and I finished my last career here. But we always wanted to come back. And then when I say the 360 view, I think that experience with my brother-in-law, Paul, kind of it completed that circle, because I saw at that time how the city of Pittsburgh responded to these three men, these three heroes that had given their lives in the service of the community. And I saw how they responded and how they came out. And just in honor of these men and to show their sympathy and their respect, I think that closed the circle for me, because having lost someone who was very dear to me and who I loved, a family member, to see somebody like that, that you care for, honored in some way, it's an element of the work I get to do now, and I don't take it lightly.
Well, it's a beautiful story and a sad story, and I remember it well. In fact, I went to the police station where all of those officers reported and spent some time with them, and I think I made a contribution to a plaque that they had and a little planting of bushes in the front of the station. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Eric Zarin. He is the chairman of the Andrew Carnegie Hero Fund Commission. And he joins us each week to tell us stories about heroes that the Andrew Carnegie Fund has awarded in Canada and the United States. Eric, thank you for being with us. And I hope, ladies and gentlemen, that you will tune in again next week when we hear about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. This is Jim Roddy, your host.